building rockets or building a company? What's more fun? Next on the K-12 Engineering Education Podcast. I'm Pius Wong in Austin, Texas. Aerospace engineer Mashal Ashamimri designed technology for NASA and Raytheon, and then formed her own business designing rockets to launch low Earth orbit satellites. As a current STEM education advocate and social media influencer with almost 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, Mashal spoke with me from Florida, all about her unique path in engineering and entrepreneurship.
So my name is Mashal Ashamimri. I am an aerospace engineer. I am also a commercial pilot. I am also a scuba diver. I was inspired to become an aerospace engineer when I was 6 years old. My parents are originally from Saudi Arabia, but I was born and raised in the U.S. And so one day when I was six, my mom took me to the deserts in Aneza. Aneza is a small town in Saudi that has amazing sand dunes. And she took me at night. And when I was there at night, it's so dark and there's like basically no light pollution whatsoever. And I looked up at the sky and I was like in awe of the amount and the density of stars in the sky. And so I kept asking my mom and my sister, "Mom, what's that? What is this? Why is the sky so full of these stars? And what are they made out of? And why some flicker more than others? Why are some flicker red, others flicker blue? What's going on here? And how far are they? And how do I get there? How do we know what's there?" And I kept asking so many questions. And I felt like my mom tried to answer as best as she could, but it never really quenched my thirst for knowledge. So I decided from that moment, I was like, well, guess what? The best way to understand what the stars are is to go to space. And the only way you can go to space is to make rockets. Therefore, I need to make rockets. But I didn't stop asking. So I kept asking. And my sister, Sarah, who's a year and 3 months older than I am, got so fed up with my questioning. And she said, "Hey, listen." And remember, we were kids. She's like, "Listen, I'm tired of you asking questions. Here's how these stars were made." She got a piece of paper and then put some glue on it and then threw some glitter. And she's like, "See this?" And she picked up the paper and obviously the glitter stuck there. She's like, "See, this is exactly what God did. So leave us alone. We're done with you asking us questions." So I felt it was kind of brilliant what she said. But I was like, it's not enough. So I have to go up there and I need to know what this stuff is made out of. So I decided the best way is to become the person that makes these rockets to take me there. And it stuck.
At 6 years old.
Until now. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So even as a kid, you kind of knew that rockets existed, that you could go up there, or you believed that you could go up there and build things to go up there. Did you have some kind of influences beyond your family bringing you to look at the stars?
I mean, I was always very curious as a child. So I used to like break things apart just to put them back together. So like, for example, the VCR once, I mean, if you are familiar with VCR, the VCR one time broke down. And so I decided to take it upon myself to fix it. And I have never obviously seen what it looks like. So I just pulled everything apart. And then I like looked around and what seemed odd to me is what I wanted to fix. And somehow I managed to figure it out. Like back then there was no YouTube. You can find out how to do things. But, you know, sometimes I was successful. Sometimes I actually totaled the entire instrument and my mom would get a little bit upset. But I was always curious. And I remember when I was in, I think, fifth or sixth grade, I asked my mom, like, maybe some of your listeners are familiar with Encarta. It was like an encyclopedia. So my dad got me my first computer. And all I did was like go onto Encarta and research everything, like every single topic you can imagine. All I did was research and read and watch videos that they had and read and watch videos to try to learn something. So on the weekends, that's what I would spend my time doing. And then during the week, as soon as I finished my homework, that's what I would do. And so at some point I told my mom for my birthday, I want every encyclopedia you can find. And she did. She found all like over 12 different encyclopedias in different subjects and one that is a general one. And all I did was read and replicate. So I would read like an experiment and try to do the experiment at home. Sometimes it was not the smartest thing to do because I almost got hurt a couple of times, especially the chemical ones.
Like, for example?
So one thing I read was, you know, trying to understand exothermic reaction. And so the experiment had, you put zinc and then you put hydrochloric acid and then you will feel it heat up. And then obviously you have the fumes coming out. Somehow I managed to find hydrochloric acid in fifth grade and I bought it. Okay. And I did this stuff at home with no hood and it was a concentrated hydrochloric acid. And I was so excited about it when I went to school and my teacher was going to do the experiment in class, I wanted to, you know, tell her I already did this and I know what I'm talking about. So I said that and she's like, how do you have hydrochloric acid? I was like, I bought it from the store. She's like, how did this guy sell you this when you're a kid? I was like, I don't know. I guess he thought I could just buy it. So she called my mom and told her, your daughter is playing with very dangerous chemicals at home with no hood and she could get in serious trouble. So then my mom raided my room, took all the stuff and donated it to the school.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. So sometimes it's a little dangerous. And you know, what's funny is for a while after those experiments I did, I actually had to be on an inhaler for a minute because it obviously hurt my lungs, but luckily it wasn't permanent damage. It was just little.
Wow. So let that be a lesson, I guess, for all parents and children there. So how were your parents through all this? I know that it seems like your mom got angry at certain points, but also they were supportive.
Very supportive, because my mom, it's almost my mom would watch from afar just to see how far I would go in terms of trying to learn. So my mom allowed me to explore and read and do all the stuff. My dad, same thing. He always encouraged, my dad always said, if you want to be something, you better be the best at it, not mediocre at it. So you need to go all the way and you need to learn as much as you can. And my dad always said, you know, I don't care if what you want to do with your life is to do basket weaving, just be the best at basket weaving. Mm. So he was always encouraging. So luckily I have a very strong support from my family to explore and to be someone that actually has a lot of curiosity and is unafraid to go seek out the information that will quench my thirst. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was very fortunate, thankfully.
So later, after all this exploration in your childhood, you did study aerospace engineering and applied math, I understand, in Florida. Can you tell me about your path to getting this official engineering education?
So as I mentioned to you, I was curious and trying to break things apart and fix them. When I was in high school, I actually did robotics also. Mm. So that just shows you the pathway. I was more inclined towards engineering because in my high school here in Miami, I did the first robotics competition twice and BattleBots. I don't know if you're familiar with BattleBots. Most likely you are.
I only know BattleBots from Comedy Central. Is that? So you were on that?
Yes.
Wow. We should find the episode.
I don't know if ours was filmed.
Okay.
I think it was just part. I don't remember, to be honest. I don't know if they aired it or not. But first robotics competition, you know about first robotics competition, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did that twice. And we won first in our division, which is 80 teams, and third on the nation, which was 400 teams.
Oh, wow.
Back then. So from there, you know, I had some, you know, we manufactured stuff. We had an engineering sort of brain or thought process and so forth. Mm-hmm. So in college, you know, I obviously knew what I wanted to do, which is aerospace engineering, because I wanted to do rockets. Mm-hmm. So I majored in aerospace engineering initially only. And then in my, the first semester of my second year, Dr. Simen Coxall, who was my Calc 2 math teacher or math professor, sorry, she told me that I was really good at math and that I should consider majoring in math also. Mm. So I said, okay, great, let's do it. And she said, you know, aerospace has so much math, I might as well get another degree. I said, okay, I agree. And then she's the one that pushed me also and made me more engaged with respect to math. We created the Infinity Math Club. I know it sounds really nerdy, but it was really nerdy because all we did is math and solve math problems that are more complex. We also did a lot of integration B and algebra Bs. You know how you have spelling Bs? These are actual math Bs.
So a competitive
Okay. Yeah. So guess who's the one that actually wrote all the competition?
Wow. Okay. So you were spending your extracurricular free time instead of going to parties and doing the TV or Hollywood college experience. You were having your fun doing math competitions and writing math problems.
Yeah. So I remember for the math B, Dr. Coxall was like, Mish, you need to calm down. You're getting really complicated. So the people would come up and it's two people against each other. And the one that solves the problem fastest is the one that goes to the next level. And so I made the problems harder and harder as they go along. And then I made them so hard that Dr. Coxall was like, nah, that's too much. So then we would have to dial it down a little bit. I mean, I did party in college, but I certainly spent, but I was like responsible.
Sure.
So what I used to do is, you know, I would wake up super early in the morning, study for all the subjects that I had to study. And 7 p.m. I would stop. And then I allow myself to enjoy life with my friends. And then I come, regardless of when I come home, even if I come home at 3 a.m., I'm going to wake up at 5 in the morning to continue my process. So I was, the thing is, I'm very disciplined. So I did that, and that's what helped. So I kind of tried to balance that out. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So in college, like I said, so it's math. I did a lot of math. And the reason why I got another degree in math is because of Dr. Coxall. And then I did aerospace as well. For my senior design project was a rocket called S3. We had to kind of downsize it a couple of times because of funding. But the idea was, first, we wanted to have a rocket that goes to the idea was to go to the edge of the troposphere, so about 60,000 feet.
Okay.
To collect weather data. So it's kind of like a sounding rocket. Mm-hmm. And then bring it back. Then because of funding, they told us, oh, you know, you're going to need to downsize it. So we wanted to experiment with stabilizing a rocket with spin. So spin stabilizing a rocket, which this exists today. So we wanted to experiment with that and create a rocket and downsize it to something smaller than that. And that was for my bachelor's degree.
You're talking about all these things that sound pretty intense. In my experience, and from what other students tell me, getting an engineering degree can take a long time, even more than 4 years, let alone doing a second major. I know you're very disciplined, but were there any challenges that you faced in getting all this stuff done?
I mean, I'm sure I had a lot of challenges, to be honest. Look, one of the things that really, really helped me with aerospace engineering, because aerospace is not easy.
Right.
But the thing is, you don't do things because they're easy. You do things because you want to challenge yourself. It wasn't easy, but what made it easy for me is the fact that I'm really good in math. And so when you're really good in math, a lot of the engineering becomes a lot simpler. Like the reason why I'm saying this is because a friend of mine who's also an aerospace engineer was struggling in aerospace. And the reason why is because his math skills were not that strong. Mm-hmm. So he wouldn't get, you know, equations. Like I was one of those people, like in my master's, for example, that would find errors in the equations in the textbooks and would tell the professor, by the way, this equation is wrong. Because what I do is I don't trust the textbook. I derive every equation. And that's how I pick up these, you know, it could be a typo. It could be, but if it's a typo and then the student uses the equation, guess what? It's the wrong equation. So if you do derive everything, then you know the source and you know what you get. And if there's a discrepancy, you can immediately pick it up. So for sure, one of the things that made it easier for me is the fact that I was good in math and I enjoyed it. So it's so much fun. Like I would get excited to do this stuff, like really excited to do math problems. And the harder the problem, the more excited I got for some reason. And then I always used to say, like, what's funny with engineering and math is that as soon as you do very complex math, easy math becomes hard. I don't know how that works. Like, you know, you're trying to like add two things and it takes me longer than like solving the heat equation. I don't know why that is.
It's a different type of thinking. I understand what you mean.
Yeah.
And you know, Michelle, that brings up a good question, because going back again to before college, would you say you were as interested in math throughout your entire life? I know you were interested in space and the stars, but what about this math thing, since it was so pivotal?
That is a very good question. I remember when I was in third grade, we were doing the multiplication tables. And I remember the teacher would have us stand up and like, she would ask us, you know, whatever, 8 times 8 or whatever, and you have to answer. And I got a few of them wrong, and she got so mad at me. And I remember I went to my grandma's house right after, and all I tried to do was to remember them because I was like trying to memorize them.
Wow.
Right. So there, for that moment, I felt like I'm not good at math. And it's so funny. Like when I look back at it now, I'm like, oh my God, I was struggling in third grade to remember the multiplication table. And, you know, it's so different. And I didn't know, like when you're a kid, you really don't know if you're really that good. But when I was in, I think, seventh grade, that's when I realized I'm actually good at it. Because each class had a different math teacher and they would compete against each other, the teachers.
Oh, weird.
So, yeah. And so I remember when it was like a new, like, let's say from seventh grade to eighth grade, the math teacher for, let's say, class A and class B, the math teacher for class A was fighting to have me in her class for me to be moved to her class because that other class has another student. So that's when I realized, oh my God, I'm actually wanted for math skills.
That's so interesting. Like your story tells me of the importance of, I guess, your teachers and other people encouraging you in a way, because I guess you didn't necessarily know that yourself. Is that a correct assumption?
100% correct. Because it was the teachers that I didn't, you know, like for me, it was just, okay, solving the math problem. And sometimes I struggled because when I was exposed to math in seventh and eighth grade, it was like basically introductory analysis, which is what they teach in college, which is basically proofs. And it's not like simple geometric proofs. It's using theories and postulates from different scientists to try to prove a specific condition in a math problem. So it was very high level math. And I remember struggling with it at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But then the teacher took time to spend with me to explain. And then it was like an inflection point. Something clicked. And then it became so easy for me to prove this thing, prove that thing. And then my brain started to think differently. And so 100%, my teachers definitely had an influence.
So I want to go back to your college work and maybe right after college. I know that you started to do some work with NASA, right? At that time, how did that happen?
So right after I graduated with my aerospace engineering bachelor's degree and applied mathematics bachelor's degree, I immediately went in to do my master's. And in my, obviously, as you know, when you do your master's, you need to have to do research, especially if you're doing a master's of science. When I was still doing my bachelor's, I went to Dr. Kirk, who is a professor at the university who taught like both rockets and mission analysis course, as well as aerodynamics, as well as air breathing engines. So he was a professor for multiple classes in aerospace that I took. And he was younger, you know. Like he was maybe in his 30s, like late 30s when I met him or when he was my professor. So when I met with him and I was like, listen, Dr. Kirk, I want to do my master's. What research projects are there and so forth? So he was telling me like the spectrum of all the things that, you know, different entities were interested in. One of them was designing a nuclear thermal rocket for Mars mission. You know, people are familiar with chemical rockets, which is what you see basically launch every day. But not a lot of people are familiar with nuclear rockets. And nuclear rockets are very powerful because the amount of energy you can extract out of a nuclear fission is 10 million times that of chemical engine. So it is the future. And if you want to get to Mars faster, and one of the things that you have to be concerned about when you talk about manned missions is crew exposure to radiation and microgravity in space. So one of the things you want to do to mitigate that is to reduce the time it takes to get to Mars. So I was very excited about that. Why? Because it, in my opinion, it is the future of space travel, is to change from the combustion engine to something else, you know, something more advanced, something more powerful, something that gives you very high ISPs, which is basically a measure of the efficiency of the rocket. It's basically double that of a chemical rocket. So I was so excited and I told Dr. Kirk, yeah, this is exactly what I want to do. And so he said, okay, great. Guess who's funding this project? NASA. And so he told NASA that I wanted to be the graduate research person on this. And they agreed. They wanted me to be on this project. And that's how I started my work with NASA as research. So research on nuclear thermal rockets for Mars mission. So it was funded by NASA Marshall Space Flight Center. And because this is the type of stuff that they do, and they basically paid my tuition and they paid me a stipend. So yeah. I was very lucky that my master's, I paid $0.
Nice.
As a matter of fact, I got paid.
That's the way to do it for engineering, yeah. Especially.
Exactly.
Is Florida then, there's a big space industry over there, kind of like in Texas, because NASA's over there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, remember back then, especially when the space shuttle was still around, there were a lot of aerospace companies, and there still is a lot of aerospace companies in Florida, especially it's called the Space Coast for a reason. Like in the central Florida is the Space Coast because most of these companies are there.
Speaking of aerospace companies, we should get to your company pretty soon. But I did want to talk about Raytheon too, because that's a big name, I think, in engineering and in aerospace that a lot of people know. You worked with Raytheon too, right? Could you describe that?
Yeah. So right after my research with NASA and finishing up my master's, I actually wanted to do my PhD. The thing is, the nuclear research funding was cut because of the recession at the time. And I had personal issues, like my stepmom died, and that really affected me significantly. And I was under a lot of pressure during my master's, and especially, you have so much pressure. I was also teaching two courses when I was doing my master's. So it was just too intense. And I really wanted to do my PhD, but given the recession and all that, I was like, you know what, maybe I should just start working. So then I started working at Raytheon. So right after my master's, I moved to Arizona, worked for Raytheon, which was really exciting because it was working on rockets. And I was in something called advanced programs within guidance, navigation, and control section in aerodynamics, the aerodynamics department. So what we did is basically a lot of designing and predictive analysis for rockets. And that's what I did. And because I was in advanced programs, I worked on 22 different rockets. So I had a lot of exposure to different rockets, designing, and so many other things, the details of which I obviously can't tell you.
Sure, yeah.
That's basically the gist of it. And I enjoyed it because it was a lot of, I love coding, and I code a lot to predict behaviors of stuff and rockets. And predictive analysis is one of my strong suits in simulation and design. You obviously design it, then you predict how it's going to behave and so forth. And then when it actually flies, you compare the two. And if there's any changes, then you apply that to the next model you're going to use. So you have a higher fidelity. So it was really cool.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I was wondering, do you think your education properly prepared you for that amount of computational work you were doing?
I think my research certainly helped, because when I was doing the nuclear thermal rocket research, I basically wrote a thermofluids code from scratch I needed to model what's going on. And the thing is, the most important thing when you create a code, especially like when I was doing it for the nuclear stuff, you have to benchmark it. So in order for me to validate that my code has the correct logic in predicting what's happening, I had to compare my thermofluids code output to what actually happened during the testing of the NERVA program in the U.S. The NERVA program is the nuclear rocket program that was in the 1960s and 70s, where they tested 20 different nuclear rocket designs. And so I had to benchmark it. So one of the critical things is to benchmark. Once you learn how to benchmark, and you see that your code does well, then you keep growing. For 100% while I was at Raytheon, my skill set for predictive analysis and modeling certainly increased. But did school prepare me for it? Not necessarily. I wouldn't say that. That's why, like when I was teaching at UM, I was telling I remember sending and sitting down and sending an email to the head of the department. And I said, you know what I would like to do is, I would like to create a real course, like real life course in engineering, where it teaches people reality, not just academics. Mm-hmm. And that's missing. Like basically one of the courses I wanted to add in the universities is aerospace entrepreneurship. No one teaches you anything about that.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And that's critical.
I guess you had to figure all that out yourself. I know we didn't get to that yet, but can you talk about your own experience with entrepreneurship? You had your own aerospace consulting company. How did that come about? And what was that like?
That's a good question. So right after Raytheon, and when I left, I had two options. It was a recession at the time. No one was hiring. Everybody actually was laying off people because there was a significant decrease in the budgets for a lot of these companies. I had two options, either sit around and wait for an opportunity or companies to get back on track, or create my own opportunity. So I decided, you know what, let me create my own opportunity. And so initially when I started, and people don't know, a lot of people don't know this, when I started, I actually started with designing a light sport aircraft, not rockets, because I wanted to create an airplane that is affordable so that the cost to become a pilot is less, so that you attract more people to become pilots, because there is a shortage of pilots. So instead of paying $12,000, I wanted them to pay $6,000 to get their private pilot license and so forth. And the light sport category was introduced in 2004, if I'm not mistaken. And it's basically a smaller plane. And the newer ones that were coming, they can run on avgas or mogas. So mogas is like, you know, this thing you put in your car. So it becomes cheaper. So the idea there was, okay, if I design an airplane and the engine can take both avgas or gasoline that you put in your car, then it's great, because then the cost is cheaper. And then the plane itself is newer than, you know, the Cessna 172 that's been there for like over 30 years. Like most schools use old Cessna 172s that are falling apart. So the idea is, I'm going to give you an airplane that costs as much as a used Cessna, but it's new and it has all the new equipment, and it has an engine that can run on either avgas or mogas. You know what I mean? So then it reduces the cost. So that's how I started Michelle Aerospace. And then after doing a feasibility study with, you know, trying to get the actual design that I want manufactured with an existing manufacturing plant, and then once that picks up, then I will have my own manufacturing plant here in the US. But to get, you know, the plane sooner, I needed to work with like someone who already makes airplanes, but then can use my design. You know what I mean? Doing the feasibility, it just, they couldn't meet the price that I wanted to sell at. And so that became, I was like, all right, that's not going to work. Okay, I guess I'm going to have to kill this project. So I killed it. Then I started Michelle Aerospace because at the time we were trying to capture some of the SBIR contracts, so small business innovative research stuff in like rockets related and so forth. And I had an employee that used to work for Raytheon also, but he left Raytheon. And so I hired him, you know, after some time. He's much older. And he said, you know, you love rockets and I want to introduce you to somebody. His name is Rick Lohr, because he loves rockets too. And he has a lot of experience. And I think you two should have a conversation. So we had a conversation, Rick and I, and I flew to Arizona because he was in Arizona. And it's by coincidence that all these people were ex Raytheon employees. It's not like we knew each other, and we never knew each other at Raytheon.
And it is a big company.
Yeah, exactly. So then I met with him and we decided to tackle the gap in the market for small satellites. A small satellite category is any satellite that is 500 kilograms or 1200 pounds or less. So nothing beyond 1200 pounds, right? What they have to do is they launch as secondary or tertiary payloads on larger rockets, which means they're at the mercy of the schedule of the primary payload, not on when they're ready. So some of them have to wait 3 years before they get a launch. And they pay a lot of money to piggyback, because if there's any catastrophic failure or any type of failure, the rocket company is not going to risk the primary payload. They're going to risk the secondary payload or tertiary payload, because they're like, okay, the primary payload is a success, is the whole purpose of this launch. You know what I mean? And this actually happened in 2013, if I'm not mistaken, where one of the SpaceX Merlin engines failed. And there was an Orbicom satellite, which was launching as a secondary payload. It was 146 kilograms. And SpaceX obviously is not going to risk the primary payload. So they dropped this Orbicom satellite and whatever it is, but it couldn't get enough delta V to maintain that orbit. And so, but the primary payload got there. So they didn't risk it. So they were at the, to SpaceX, it's a successful flight. But Orbicom lost their satellite. They only got 4 days worth of data. And then that's it. So then that's $20 million down the drain. So for that satellite. So they face these issues. The idea is, I want to create a rocket that is cost effective. So number one, when you want to launch with me, it's not that expensive. That's one. Number two, you are my primary payload. You are not my secondary payload. And so my mission is to deliver you to whatever orbital altitude you need to be at. And that's it. So you're my primary payload. So I'm a dedicated, cost-effective rocket targeting small satellites. That was the purpose of Mishal Aerospace. And we started, all our rockets were designed in-house. We manufactured in-house. We did our first static test of the hybrid rocket. And we did hybrid rocket for the booster, for the MOV, which is the orbital vehicle. Because I had an MSV, which is basically taking the booster, which is a hybrid rocket, as a suborbital rocket. So in other words, for those that want to test their telemetry and all that on their satellite, they can easily put their payload on the SV, which is a suborbital vehicle. And then once they tweak all their issues, then they can launch with the OV, which is an orbital vehicle, which has basically the main engine. It has four main engines that are liquid fuel. And then the boosters are the hybrid rocket, which is the same hybrid rocket I'm using in the SV. It just, you remove the fins and then you put it as boosters on the OV, the orbital vehicle. And you can add as many boosters as you want, depending on the payload that you're carrying. So I can get up to 10 boosters, or it could be 4 boosters, 2 boosters, 6 boosters, whatever. Hmm. So it's that way I have a versatility. So if I have one day a client that only has, let's say, 500 pounds to put to space, I don't have to wait to launch 1,200 pounds. You know, I can launch this person using, you know, the main liquid rocket and then maybe 2 boosters, for example.
Hmm.
And then the boosters are reusable.
So yeah. This is a lot of, I mean, I know you were speaking about it in just a few minutes, but it was a lot of not only engineering work on your part, but it sounded like a lot of business research, finding out who was going to pay for all this. Was there a market for all this? Was that something that you knew beforehand? Did you just learn this on the fly as well?
Yeah. So that's a good question, because basically I had to learn as I go. And so, look, my dad always said something that's really funny. He said, having a degree to him means nothing. He's like, the only thing a degree says is that you can learn. So even if you don't know something, you can always learn. So when I started the company, have I ever started a company before? No. Do I know what I'm doing? Absolutely not. I got in and I tried it and, you know, I asked around. I'm not afraid to ask people. So for example, like even at the beginning, I wanted to start Mishal Aerospace. What did I need to do? I asked around to find out, like, how do you even start a company? So they're like, oh, all you need to do is go to sunbiz.com and register the company. So I did that. I registered the company. Then I was like, okay, what about the tax stuff? They're like, oh, get an accountant. So then I got an accountant. And then I was like, okay, what about, like, as I started to grow and I needed transactional lawyers and so forth like that. But all this stuff I wasn't aware of, I had to learn it as I go through. The engineering stuff I knew for sure. And there were things that I didn't know that I learned from engineering. But obviously, like market research, like even with the airplanes, you know, how did I know that it was not feasible? How did I know that I needed to meet that target price? Because I did a lot of research. I read about all these planes. I looked up, I physically went to multiple flight schools to ask and have them do questionnaires. And these questionnaires that I actually developed and wrote, I gave to each one of them. They did it. I took this information. I collected it. I had a database. You know, like I actually went and tested the market for the airplanes. For the rockets, I bought a lot of information. Some of information I bought, you know, like you can find, and some information where I had to hire some market research experts. But I didn't do that at the beginning. When I recognized that there's a market gap, I did a lot of research and found the market gap. And then once I got into it deeper and deeper and had funding, then I actually hired somebody like a market research just to enable me to have a lot of data that I can show to investors and be like, look, this is real. We have a severe issue and there's a gap in the market and that's what I'm trying to target. And this is how much money is out there. And this is how much money I want to make out of it. So let's say one capture, 1%, 2% or so forth.
A very collaborative venture. You can't rely on just you working alone, basically.
Absolutely not. So what you do is you start off, it's similar to engineering in the sense that, you know, first when you design a rocket, And before you test the rocket, you're going to do a 1 degree, like a one-doff, to try to estimate what it's going to look like. Once you see that, okay, you're in the ballpark, then you move on to a 3-doff, and then you move on to a 6-doff. Look, the fidelity grows as you go along. So once I realized there is a gap in the market, then I had, like from my research, then I realized, okay, now that I have some funding, it's important for me to know all the details of this market. So then I hired somebody. So it's like it almost builds on each other. But for sure, you can't rely on yourself. You have to get people that are experts in that specific area.
Yeah. Are you still consulting with Michal Aerospace right now?
So with Michal Aerospace, the unfortunate thing is we succeeded technically. So we tested our hybrid rocket. It works. And I had an investor initially in the rocket company. We put a lot of money into the company, but then I had an investor that was going to fund the whole project, but then he ran into some financial issues and couldn't. Mm-hmm. And so then I looked for investors for 2.5 years. There was many of them that really liked it and really thought like what we did was impressive, but they couldn't put money because they already put money in another rocket company that I will not say who. But they put money in another rocket company that is not necessarily a competitor. But you have to understand, LP, like launch vehicle provider, is what we are called because you're providing a launch service.
Okay.
And we make the rockets, is a very high risk long term business. So even if two rocket companies are not necessarily competitors, if you're an investor, you're like, no, it's long-term and high risk. I already put money in one. I'm not going to put money in the same type of business. I'd rather put it in an app or in a building or something else, like diversify your portfolio. So some of them understood aerospace, so that was great. And those are the ones that I really wanted because they really appreciated the amount of work that we did. But unfortunately, they already put money in another rocket company. And then those that don't understand aerospace are scared because they're like, I don't know rockets. I know real estate. I'll put money in real estate. I don't know rockets. I know, you know, technology development in apps because it's, you know, less capital and I get my money sooner. I only care about ROI. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It sounds a lot like a lot of engineering entrepreneurship industries, really. I think I hear the same thing from the biomedical side as well. A lot of people won't invest in those companies because there's so much that they consider as risky or they don't know about it.
Yeah, but with high risk comes high return. They don't want to put their money there. So it's understandable.
Yeah.
So then once I realized I wasn't going to be able to have funding, you have to understand it was like a race to try to get to this static test of the hybrid rocket because, you know, I was running out of money and I'm trying to find investors and so far I was unsuccessful at getting new investors. And I had an option and I have employees that rely on getting their salaries. So March of 2014, I sat down with everybody and I said, look, guys, you know, I've been looking for investors for 2.5 years. And so far, I have not been successful. I'm still trying to get investors, but I need you to understand that as of today, you know, I can only pay your salaries up to September. Beyond that, I will not be able to do so. And August is our static test. So, and for me, it's do or die. I really need to get the static test, but I cannot hold you. If you want to leave now, that's up to you. You have to make that decision on your own. I need to be clear that you understand that beyond September, I cannot pay your salary. So if you want to stick around with me and try to do the static test in August, that would be great, but I cannot force you to do so. You have a choice. You can stay with me till August, we do the static test, but recognize that if I don't find an investor between March and August, then I'm going to have to let you go. And it was a very, you know, emotional moment for me because if they left, I'm pretty much, you know, I'm pretty much on my own. I can't do the static test on my own. I need these people with me. And at the same time, I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into this. You know what I mean? And so to see all the hard, and it's not like the engineering was not right or, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. No, I knew there was something there and it's a hybrid rocket and hybrid rockets. There's not a lot of hybrid rockets out there, you know, like it was just exciting and I really wanted it to work. And I, you know, had a vision for this company to be huge and to be delivering payloads, you know, in 2 years, like once we get into production to have like more than, you know, 3 launches a month, that sort of thing. You know what I mean? I had all these images. And then my goal was to go to the moon, bring back samples to Earth. So I had a very big vision, and to be at a point where now I have to basically reduce my dream to just at least getting that static test. And maybe that too, I may not be able to do, because I have to be honest with my employees. And if they don't want to be there, I can't force them to. But thank God, all of them, because I guess they are also passionate about it. They said, no way, we're staying with you until we do the static test, knowing that if you don't find investors and you can't pay us beyond September, that's acceptable to us. Mm-hmm. So everybody stayed. We continued. We had problems to the last second from a technical standpoint. We had, you know, issue after issue, and I was running out of money, and I was like, okay, we got to think differently. And then we finally got things together. We got to the Mojave Desert. We started the test. Then there was an issue with the valve. Luckily, the site that we wanted to test at was available the next day. Like, no one booked it. So we're like, okay, we'll come back tomorrow. We'll get the valve and we'll replace it. So we did that. Then, you know, the next day we started everything. We're about to do everything. We can't get the pressure correctly on this tank, the oxygen tank, to the last second, for 2 hours struggling to do it. And then Rick tells me, you know, we've been trying to get this pressurized. What do you want us to do? I said, do or die. That's it. I was like, these two things are going to happen. Either I will die, or we get this rocket to function. That's everything I got right there. So we tried, and sure enough, we tested it and it functioned, and it was perfect. Perfect after all the struggles.
Yeah.
But the rocket worked. It performed as expected. And it was a bittersweet moment, honestly. It was very painful for me, because I know we know what we're doing technically, but now I have to put the company on hold because I can't continue. I don't have money.
Right.
It was so hard for me. Like, after that, I think I was depressed for over 6 months.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I was very depressed, very hurt. You know, like, I was upset with aerospace. I was just like tired.
Wow.
And exhausted, because it's, look, when you're an entrepreneur, they tell you always, do not fall in love with your business. It's very hard when you're passionate about like rockets and space. For me, it was very hard because I knew it was needed, and we did it right. All I needed is money. And I was, you know, unfortunately, I had to put the company on hold. But at least, you know, I know that I am capable of doing it regardless. All I needed was money.
Yeah. I appreciate your story of your startup, because it's like so many startups, you run into lots and lots of difficulties. And we don't always get to hear those difficulties. We just hear about the Facebooks that make billions, or SpaceX, just to use another company in the aerospace industry. But I'm sure that there's tons and tons of people with similar stories. And I want to know, well, number one, what are your entrepreneurship plans today? What are you doing with that today? And how do you continue, I guess, after this kind of heartbreak?
After this kind of heartbreak, I was asked to consult. I was asked to consult, and I had to move to France for a while. So I was in France for 2 years, but consulted for about, I think, 3 years in Paris. But because at the beginning, I was basically traveling a lot, so I had no location. I was basically living in an airplane, but I was basically consulting for a company. Then I left them, and then I came back to the US, and I focused a lot on getting my pilot's license. So I got my private pilot, my instrument rating, my commercial pilot, and multi-engine. And then I was teaching at the university. And then I am also a consultant still for a very large defense and aerospace company in the US. I don't know if I can name it or not. So I'll just.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, we know that there's a lot of secrets in engineering. Oftentimes, we can keep it that way.
But so I am consulting.
Yeah.
So I've been consulting, and I am still consulting in rockets for a large defense and aerospace. Well, aerospace, which is defense and space company in the U.S. One of the large ones.
So I know that we've been speaking a while. If you got time, I got a lot of questions. I don't want to keep you longer than you need to be. One of the things I wanted to ask you, though, was I read that you have the title, I guess, of the first female aerospace engineer in the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, including Saudi Arabia. How did you get that title?
So I didn't know at the time. But as I told you, my parents are from Saudi. So I used to go to Saudi from time to time. And then when I got my aerospace engineering degree, they did an interview in a newspaper in Saudi about me. And basically, I was the only woman ever to get into this field. So as time passed and more things I did, it became more apparent that I was the first person to ever be an aerospace engineer in the entire GCC, which is Saudi Arabia, you know, like the Gulf Council. And so that title was valid because I was the only one at the time. Now, I'm hoping that changes and I will, I mean, that changes. I obviously, once you're the first, that's it. But I mean, it changes in the sense that there will be more women in this field.
I was wondering, like, sometimes it feels weird to be, quote unquote, the first of anything. And I don't know if that comes with any kind of pressure or do you, I just wonder how you feel about that.
Like, well, number one, when I obviously did this, this wasn't my goal to be the first at this. I just had a passion and followed it. And it just so happens that I was the first person. It definitely comes with a responsibility. And I started doing this social media stuff related to rockets in space in Arabic. So I have like a YouTube channel. I have like, you know, over 3.5 million views. Mm-hmm. I have like 91,000 subscribers or whatever. But the reason why is because I give them content that is scientific, but simple enough for everyone to understand about space-related topics, about advice I have for people based on my experience. But a lot of it is scientific and space, like aviation, aerospace, and space-related. And the idea is because there isn't content in Arabic that is scientific, very rare, and to do it in a way that is also attractive to people in the sense that, you know, there's some humor in there, there is something relatable. Like I always try to relate things to the people, whoever, whether it's my students and or anybody. So I always try to have a connection between something they know and the science that we're trying to describe. And that's what I do in these videos, is to try to encourage them, to make them explore, because not everybody is born knowing what they want. Some people still, even as they get older, they still don't know what they want. So if I expose them to scientific topics, who knows, maybe that sparks an interest and maybe that makes them, you know, start researching things and then recognizing like, oh my God, this is the field I want to get into. That is the whole purpose of trying to like give back and trying to encourage people that, you know, science is exciting. It does a lot of cool stuff and it doesn't have to be all aerospace, you know, aerospace and medicine. It could be anything else. But the idea is once you plant that seed of curiosity in people, and they start to go research on their own, then they discover things that they weren't even aware of. And that was the whole point of these videos, is to inspire, to educate, to plant the seed.
Yeah, it seems like you've been doing something right, I guess, to reach youth. For other STEM education supporters, what advice would you have for them on how to reach youth? Do they have to be on TikTok? Do they have to be creating videos? What should they be doing?
Yeah, I mean, what worked is that I started to create videos. And I think one of the reasons people like my videos is because my Arabic is good, but they can tell that it's not my first language. You know what I mean? And for them, they enjoy it because they're like, oh my God, she's trying really hard to explain this scientific topic in a language that she's not on. Like and what's funny is I have two videos that are the same topic, one in English and one in Arabic. Uh-huh. The English one is maybe 3 minutes shorter than the Arabic one. And that just gives you an idea of like the amount of struggle it takes, even though I edit the videos and so forth. Yeah. But one of the things that attracts them is the fact that they see that, and they always tell me that they see that in the videos they see that I'm genuine. I am who I am. I don't become a different person because the camera is on, because they see it. And so that genuine personality of the person that's presenting needs to come through. And I think that is one of the things that attracts people, because sometimes I attract people that have zero interest in what I'm talking about. Zero. They're like, I have no interest, but I watch your videos because I find you and what you're saying interesting. But do I find the topic interesting? No, but I listen to it anyways. And they learn regardless whether they like it or not. So make sure your authentic self comes through the camera. Certainly videos are a lot more interactive. We see today that a lot more people are willing to watch a video than read a book. So if you can present the information in an easy way, that would be relatable to people. So I would encourage, especially for scientific topics, that you try to relate whatever it is that you're saying to something that they do understand. Like, as an example, when I was trying to describe, you know, how variation and pressure, I have to give it to them in a way. And when I was talking about, you know, how to determine the ceiling of an aircraft and so forth from an engineering perspective, like, you know, how do you determine the ceiling of an aircraft? Like, how high can it go? Sure. And that's it.
Yeah.
So, and to explain that to them and explain the difference in pressure, I said, you know, how many of you were inside of an airplane at 35,000 feet drinking a bottle of water? And then once you land, that bottle of water squeezes. Like it becomes, it like squeezes on itself. I'm like, that is, you don't recognize that there's a variation in pressure because you, like, unless you are in a very long flight and feel like you're bloated, then you will feel it. But other than that, this is how you can describe something where they can relate to it. Another example is like when I had my students trying to describe total pressure, I actually physically had them get up and walk towards me and then continue to walk. And so one of the students had to stop once he was in front of me. And I was like, you see where he stopped? He had to stop and go around. That's how you have total pressure. And I guarantee you, because of that visual and they were part of it, they will never forget what total pressure is or stagnation pressure. So that is important in trying to depict scientific topics to your audience, is to make it relatable and for them to understand and to visualize a lot of the stuff.
So Michelle, how can people find your YouTube videos or just more information about you?
They can do so either through my site, which is basically www.michelleashimemri.com, which has both Arabic and English.
Okay, I'll put a link to that up too.
Yeah, and that will guide you through everything, my social media and my YouTube channel as well. You know, so long as I get more requests to do things in English, I will do them in English because I have some videos in English, some videos in Arabic, the majority of which are in Arabic, but I'll be more than happy if I have the audience in English to do it in English. It's easier for me because it's my first language.
Thank you to my guest, Michelle Ashimimri, aerospace engineer. The K-12 Engineering Education Podcast is sponsored by my studio, Pios Labs, in Austin, Texas, where I release all sorts of projects in engineering and education, like this podcast, or like my new Coordinates web toy that lets you hear what math equations sound like on the piano and guitar. Learn more about projects like these if you follow Pios Labs all over the internet. P-I-O-S-L-A-B-S. This show is in its sixth season. Wow. And it's only possible thanks to beautiful individuals donating to the show on Patreon each month. Help me continue the podcast through 2021. Donate to the show at patreon.com/PiosLabs. Visit the podcast website, regularly updated, to find show notes, links, transcripts, which take a lot of work, so do check that out, and much more. Point your browser to k12engineering.net. That's K, the number 12, engineering.net. All right. Thank you, listener. Now go off and do your own cool stuff, too.